Hello, welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast. I'm Manuel Lemus, the host of the podcast. And for this show, which will be the episode 14, the last of the year 2011, every year, as always, Michael Kimsel. Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
Bom dia.
It's not always nice to listen to your exercise of foreign languages.
And, that's not foreign to you. That's Portuguese.
Yeah, but I think for most of the audience, it is foreign. I think there is a great community of developers, either in Portugal or in Brazil, that speak Portuguese. But that's probably like 5%. And anyway, this is the last episode of the year, as I said, and I thought it would be interesting to, apart from the regular topics that about stuff that we've been seeing in the JavaScript world in the latest weeks, last month, this month, December, I thought it would be interesting to do a recapture of the 2011 year, and I think probably to be better to start with the topics of things that happened recently, then we move on to our review of 2011.
And, I agree.
Yeah, and I would like to start talking a bit about the plans for ECMAScript 6. For those not familiar with ECMAScript, it's basically the parent of JavaScript. Actually, ECMAScript is the standardization effort to define the base of the language, and ECMAScript 6 is being defined, and there are plans for interesting new features. Michael, did you look into what is being planned for ECMAScript 6? So what do you think?
Well, I had a quick look, like the let keyword. I've looked at a few of these changes that have been proposed or are in the works, but I didn't get a chance to dive into them enough. I mean, the first one I looked at was let, and it just it reminds me of basic, which I'm not sure if that's intentional or not, but I'm just not sure. I'm seeing there it's a scoping issue, but I guess I don't do enough complex JavaScript to know what impact that would have on me directly. And I suspect with a lot of these things, for people like me that use JavaScript secondarily or as an adjunct to other applications, other web stuff, it may not make a big difference directly to us, but it's going to help other people who build the building blocks, the dojos, the jQueries, the nodes, all those sorts of things. So, you know, in some sense, I'm not really sure I'm qualified to speak too much about the pros and cons of these proposed changes.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that it's probably to help optimizers to figure
engines. I hadn't considered that aspect, but yeah, probably some of these would help.
Well, I'm guessing, I'm not sure if that's the case, but if they can see that a variable is local or is global, or I mean outside the scope of the current function, the current object, probably it will help them to figure better the all the process of accessing that variable. I'm not sure if that's the case because I just read an article about a talk that was given by David Hermans on YUIConf 2011, and that seemed to be the purpose, but it didn't seem to be important. Other than that, other features that are planned, like default arguments and multi-line string.
Default argument is that this isn't going to work in IE6 and no one will adopt it. That's the default argument. Sorry.
Yeah.
That too awkward?
Okay. No, I think all this that is new will not work in the current JavaScript implementations. But these are new features that are meant for future JavaScript.
I was trying to make a bad pun. I was trying to make a good pun there, but it didn't work out. So it was really a bad pun with default arguments. Yeah. But it actually brings up a broader topic that I don't see specifically discussed in this article, but that gets down to the heart of JavaScript itself. It gets down to how we think of JavaScript server-side versus client-side in the clients that we have. And I know I've talked about this maybe in 2010, certainly at the beginning of 2011.
Yeah.
We don't have a way to change our engines. So looking at this, this kind of freaks me out a little bit. I'm wondering, these changes probably won't come about for another year or so, yeah. But how would I take advantage of those in a browser setting? Just put in, like, just start using the let keyword.
Yeah.
That's going to break a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And we have no way of giving people new JavaScript VMs other than saying, upgrade your browser. Now, I will say that the trend that we've seen this year of faster iterations, Chrome and now Firefox are going through, you know, every few weeks, there's minor automatic updates or nearly automatic updates. To the extent that we may see those happening in Safari and maybe even IE in the next couple of years, that may be less of an issue, but I still don't want to have to upgrade my entire browser
right.
just for one thing. I should... There we have JavaScript engine. There's we talk about V8 and SpiderMonkey and all these things. They are separate components, and yet they are still so inexplicably, or maybe explicably, tied to the browser itself. That I think if we'd had modular JavaScript engines that we could plug and play, we would probably have seen earlier, you know, more iterations than we've seen already. But I'm not a developer in that sense, and in some sense, the open source people would say, well, you're not qualified to talk because you're not giving patches, and I kind of agree with that, but I get that.
From the PHP world, right?
Well, not just PHP. A lot of open source in general says, you know, shut up and just submit your patches.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying I'm the one qualified to do this, but just because you're not coding directly does not mean that you can't, I think, give some constructive feedback about what would help end users, what would help people outside of people who are coding, and so on. But I'm kind of getting off topic there.
Well, a couple of things there. One thing is that this ECMAScript 6 effort is to make it standardized. And what you mentioned about the if you don't submit patches, you cannot give your opinion is something more like of the PHP world, as I comment. But PHP is not standardized at all. There is no specification for PHP. There is no equivalent to ECMAScript as there is for JavaScript.
Or Python or Ruby as well, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I think there is some standardization effort for Python. Not sure.
No, I'm saying there's more standards around Python and there's more standards around Ruby as languages than there are around PHP. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, the other thing also related with PHP is some of the features that I see here are very similar to what there is in PHP. PHP like default argument values for when you do not pass any value for a certain argument, as well multi-line strings, and also something that they call templating, which is basically you can insert some marks in the middle of a text string that gets those strings evaluate at runtime by replacing some variables with their values in the string. That is not just PHP, but it kind of reminds me of PHP a lot.
Yeah, and, actually, some of that syntax looks like Smarty.
Yeah, right. And another thing that I would like to comment regarding this, the eventual adoption of ECMAScript specification, in this case it goes to version 6, is that it will take many years to become something that is used in the JavaScript version, used in the browsers that will be used. I think that because if you look, for instance, for PHP 5, it took 4 years until the core people decided to put an end of life to PHP 4, and only then PHP 5 started getting a more serious adoption, because many providers, hosting providers, decided, they are killing it now, so we need you have an excuse to impose PHP 5 to our customers.
Mm-hmm.
And if JavaScript goes the same line, times. I think we'll need to wait a few years to see these features being implemented in the current JavaScript version using the browsers. I think
maybe we'll see some tag, either some header tag or some markup that you can put in a document that would say use this other engine, and maybe they're not quite pluggable engines, but we may have a compatibility layer that allows new code or old code to be run in the same browser at the same time.
Yeah,
that would probably be ugly, but I could probably see that happening before I see totally pluggable replaceable engines.
Well, that somehow is what was happening with Flash, because when you needed a Flash version that requires a new version of the engine, the sites could always make it show in some way that would guide the user to upgrade to a newer version, and it would work like a pluggable engine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because the Flash support is still a plugin. Well, we'll see if JavaScript engines go that route.
Or indeed, if Flash is around a year from now. Whoa, sorry, I went there.
Well,
too early? Is it too early? It's still 2011.
Yeah, well, I think we'll get back to that when we do the recapture of the year. But now moving on to another topic. One interesting library that I have seen recently is called TGV. I don't know if TGV is...
I think that's a reference. Naughty sexual term, I think. Yeah,
It's the way they call it in fast trains in France.
Oh, well, and over here it's transgendered something or other.
Yes.
Not that there's, you know, not there's anything wrong with that, but
right.
It might be. If I was to look at that, I might not use a TGV JavaScript library just because it might look one way, but then if I looked at the code underneath, it might be something totally unexpected.
Yeah.
So
never know what something means in a different country.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, this library is basically to reduce the loading times of pages by deferring the load of images, which is not exactly something new, but it's always nice to see this as a standalone library. I think I have seen some jQuery plugins to implement the same effect, but being a standalone library, if for some reason you would not like to load the jQuery as well, having this as a standalone library, which when compressed, minified, it is only 3K. I think it would be interesting, but basically that's the effect of this library. I think it is probably interesting nowadays that Google seems to, well, that's what they say, they take in account the page load times to as a factor to rank pages in the search results.
Do we know for certain if they're counting
we never know
full page load time or just the response time from the server, or maybe it's both?
Five
years ago to the idea to say they're gonna execute JavaScript code and see how long everything takes to load up would have been crazy.
We never know exactly what they do because they avoid getting into much details because
you can edit, you can tell the lady that transcribes, you can edit that out.
Well,
I meant nice
you,
people.
You were sincere, you expressed your opinion.
Or are they a sponsor? Is Google... Well, they're not going to sponsor if I keep bad-mouthing
them. Well, somehow Google sponsors the whole internet because they send a lot of traffic. Well, if we see a great drop of traffic in JS classes, then we know what caused it. Anyway, back to this library... that's it. It is aimed to reduce the page load, and for people that were looking for a solution that does just that, it is probably a good option.
What I didn't see here is I'm just wondering, because what I see it does is that instead of image source tags, you tell it data defer source. So you're changing the attribute to data defer source instead of source.
Yeah.
What does that do to people that care about validation, W3C validation? Is there
I think from what I know, any attribute that starts with word data is automatically valid. It's not.
Is it? Wow. I did not know that, but I didn't see any reference in their document about that as to what it.
Because it's basically it's.
Because everybody else knows about this except for me.
I was not going that way, but somehow that's it. It is not a new thing. It's from what I know, it's something that was defined a long time ago in the HTML standard. And so every time you want to add a custom attribute to your HTML, you can use those data
prefixes,
attributes.
Yeah,
anything that starts with data.
Wow. So like, yeah, okay.
Well, moving on to with the podcast, now we're going to talk about
Humane.js.
Did you look into that?
I'm looking at it, and it just seems to be a pile of. It doesn't work. I don't know what it's supposed to do, but it's not.
You need to click on the areas.
Oh,
now
you
see it.
They do. Yeah. Well,
there is a.
The thing was when I just changed page. When I just changed select theme, there was some little thing that would flash at the top for a moment, and then it went away. So I thought it was supposed to be doing some animation.
Yeah.
And it's not. Okay, so I have to follow the instructions.
Well, it's nothing bastards. Special. It's just a few effects that for the way you present messages to the users instead of the old ugly alert box, you can use nice effects to present messages to the user that they are shown and they also automatically fade away. The user doesn't have to be bothered to click on.
And now that I see how it works, it is interesting. I've got a project that I'm supposed to be revisiting the UI, and this has been one of those things that user notification has been trying to figure out what's a good way to do this. I like, now that I actually follow the instructions, it works. Man, it just Humane.js, guys, if you could make something that works even if I don't follow the directions, it would be much more humane. And this is probably the biggest limitation. The biggest limitation I'm seeing of this app is that it only works when you follow its directions.
Right, but you are a developer. You should figure it out. Now for your site's users, you can always use one of these ways of presenting an obtrusive, how they call it, messages to show something that is relevant for the user.
Yeah. I was thinking of just emailing them every time something happened. Like, you've updated your record. We've deleted your record. You clicked on this link, and so on.
That would be kind of slow, right?
Yeah. But
sooner or later, it would get there.
There's a strong audit trail there.
What do you mean in the?
Well, if I email them on every single click, then they have their own record of what exactly took place.
Yeah. Oh, but this is just to be a nice replacement of the old alert boxes, and I think
it does look nice. Yes.
Well, at least some of the types of effects look nice, at least for me. And moving on with the podcast, another library. Well, actually, I found it very interesting because I'm sort of old, at least compared with a good part of our audience. And this brings me back to the 80s and 90s, early 90s, late 80s, to the old Amiga computer days. Michael,
Miami Vice.
Did you have an Amiga computer? No.
I did.
So I don't know if you remember, there were, at least from what I remember back then, there was this practice of everybody exchanging music being composed by people that enjoy music and use the Amiga computers, and they use what they call the tracker programs like Sound Tracker and others.
Mm-hmm.
There is this Flood JS library that is able to read many of those music file formats and play them in a browser which supports the web audio API. And this is interesting because now you'll be able to play those old, very old tunes of the 80s.
But I have to choose a file that it knows, like a SID player or a SID file. I don't have any of these old files.
Well, there are plenty of sites on the web that have those files.
It doesn't play MP3s.
Yeah, that was not the purpose. We already talked about another library that plays MP3. Well, it still still use the Web Audio API, which seems to be only supported in the latest Chrome version. I think Chrome 17.
How's everybody going to hear my 18 Wheels of Love MP3 file? I don't think they're. Yeah, they can't play it on this.
Well, okay. That was not the purpose, but I just thought it to be interesting to comment about it, as if there are any old timers like myself that use the Amiga computers.
You'll need to turn up the volume for them when you get to this part in the podcast, because they won't be able to hear it.
Yeah.
Because they're too old.
Not that old.
What?
We are not that old.
You'll need to type in a bigger font for me, please.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, moving on with your podcast.
I wanted to mention one.
Yeah, that's
what I talked about.
Add in mind to next in line.
Yeah, okay, that's a very smooth move there, how you just casually transitioned it over as if you were going to. take two. A tool that I've recently come across is Mulberry, Mulberry, and this is a toolkit from a company called Tura, and a couple of friends of mine, it's awesome, I can just name drop like this, Matt Henry and Rebecca Murphy both work at Tura now, or work with Tura, I'm not sure exactly what the relationship is, but Tura is a company, I think, based up in Boston that does a lot of mobile app development. And what they've done, and Rebecca, I think, has taken the lead in a lot of this, is crafted this toolkit that is trying to think of how to describe this, but it's a very fast way to get up and running with PhoneGap. And the easiest way for people who are familiar with these technologies to get this is to say Rails for PhoneGap. It's very Rails-ish. It's command line utilities, Mulberry scaffold an application, Mulberry create a page. It creates an entire structure for you, a default skeleton application structure that can then be compiled into a native iOS app or a native Android app.
Yeah, it's sort of a Rails for
PhoneGap
applications.
Yep. And I got a hands-on demo from Rebecca a couple of weeks ago at our local JavaScript meetup, and it's pretty slick. I've got one project in mind that I'm thinking of using this on if I can get time by end of January, early February. I played with it. I've done a couple of local things, but I've got an actual client project in mind to use it on. It's pretty straightforward. There's one neat thing that if I can play with more, I may talk about next month, but it is a remote debugger. Actually, you wire up your app into a remote server. I think Tura runs them, but you could run your own as well. And then from your browser, you connect up and you get what in your browser, it looks very much like a step-by-step debugger to debug through your application. So you could put the app onto your mobile device and then debug it through the web, debug it over in a browser, step-by-step debugging. It's pretty slick.
Yeah.
So I only saw a quick demo of everything. And as demos goes, a lot of times, I saw some neat demos at ZenCon a couple months ago too. There's something, I don't think Mulberry is going to allow you to make every single kind of app you want. It seems to be targeted for right now a few core use cases, but it seems to make it actually almost fun to build basic apps like that. So I'm really on the lookout for more stuff coming from the Mulberry project, but also I'm hoping this will inspire other projects to make their technologies as slick and as packaged and as easy to use as Mulberry. But that's maybe all I'll say for this month.
Yeah. Well, if anything interesting will come up, I'm not on to mobile development world, but if you are more connected to that type of development, please keep talking about those new things that may come up to increase the productivity of people that work. In this case, is PhoneGap. Is it specific for PhoneGap, or is there anything for Titanium?
Right now it is just PhoneGap. It's built on top of PhoneGap. when you get Mulberry, you're getting PhoneGap and Dojo, and I think jQuery as well. So it's bundling a lot of tools together and using them in a standard way, much like Rails or Grails or something else. It's putting a nice command line interface and some default standards on top of some disparate tools. So yeah. It's nice.
Okay. Well, moving on to with the podcast. Basically, we cover several interesting topics, libraries and stuff that has been happening this month, December 2011. And now, as we have planned the earlier, it's time to do a recapture of the year 2011 in the JavaScript world. Michael, do you want to start? What was more relevant for you that has happened in 2011?
Gosh, when we first talked about this, I was initially thinking of, well, you know, this project came out, that project came out, and thinking about it, there was a whole lot of specific individual projects that have come, and some have stuck around and some have morphed and gone away. But to me, the bigger trends that continued, I think these were bigger things, and that has been the continued improvement of JavaScript in browsers, kind of to tie in with what we were talking about earlier about the incremental upgrades. Chrome and Firefox both now are pushing for rather quick iteration, and hopefully we'll see that trend happen in some other browsers, most of the major browsers as well, to get out small incremental improvements to the entire browser, but certainly JavaScript is a big portion of that. So the speed improvements that we've seen across the board in JavaScript engines, I think, have helped make more client-side apps a reality. And it's almost passe. I think a lot of people listening to this sort of stuff are this podcast and other podcasts like it probably are fairly ahead of the curve anyway. So me talking about this, saying, "Oh, this is a great thing," in some sense, it feels like, "Yeah, we've been seeing this for a few years. It's nothing all that great." But it's been more. There's such a with IE kind of or issues of IE6 lessening as well too. The average developer has more leeway to try out and to use more advanced JavaScript in their work. So while some of you listening would say, "You know, I've been doing this 2 or 3 years ago, and I've been on the cutting edge," the rest of us are now getting to catch up. And I say the rest of us, me, but other people that I meet in their day-to-day work, we've been able to take advantage of much more powerful JavaScript libraries, and these libraries are more powerful because the engines themselves are powerful. The other, I think, big thing that's happened in the last year has been the a solidification of server-side JavaScript. Node.js has really taken off as the hotness. Maybe we'll see some other competitors in that space. Certainly we'd seen Rhino and some other ones before. But the idea of JavaScript on the front and the back, server-side, client-side at the same time, has an appeal to some people. And I think we're going to see more people taking advantage of the ease of concurrency and the ease of socket connections and things that just aren't really possible with more traditional old LAMP stacks, Apache stacks, to be able to do more complex concurrency with a JavaScript-based server. You know, I don't even want to make too many predictions other than I think 2012 is going to be pretty interesting in that respect. So those are kind of the bigger meta stories that I've seen over the last year without getting into, you know, things like Mulberry is really neat, but there's probably 50 of those things that I could point to, probably, you know, one or two things a week. Oh, cool project. But the overall trend is more of these cool projects are happening because the engines are getting better. We're seeing less of a stranglehold of IE6 in the marketplace that are allowing more people to take advantage of the cool things coming out too.
That's one of the things that I also would like to highlight is I think it was Google that started this trend of iterating browser releases with high frequency. Mozilla people got the point, and they are now also iterating quicker. I don't know, but I also get this impression that Microsoft is also trying to iterate quicker, but probably not as quick as the, their competitors.
And yeah.
So we don't see too many Internet Explorer releases, but they are moving on. They are not stopped like they somehow did with IE6 for years.
Mm-hmm.
But and this is important because for the JavaScript world, because many of the cool things that we are seeing depend on the implementation of the JavaScript APIs that were already specified. There are standard documents to define them, but the browsers are not yet embracing them. And this leads me to another important thing that happened in 2011, actually not a long time ago, which is the announcement from Adobe to sort of kill the development of Flash for mobile devices. So basically they decided to not develop new versions, although they just released, I think it is probably the last version of a Flash plugin for Android 4, Ice Cream Sandwich,
mm-hmm.
which was expected because somehow the market that has devices running Android expect support for Flash, because it used to be one of the advantages of those devices when compared to iOS devices from Apple, because Apple sort of banned Flash on their hand. And my impression is that Adobe also agrees to kill Flash, but they cannot kill the market that they have, the marketplace they have built, and many companies rely on, which is the development of tools and components based on Flash that run on browsers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know until when that market will last, but I think it is positive from Adobe to signal that that market will cease to be significant. It will not be ever killed permanently. There will always be applications and sites that will use Flash, but I think once they have told everybody they cease the development, at least for mobile devices, I think the next announcement will be they also cease the development of new versions for browsers, regular browsers for desktop computers. And
I suspect that it may not be a complete ceasing. I don't think they would go that far until they have a replacement, technology. And if you're building something with their tooling, if you're using Flash Builder, there will be, I'm just making this up, but Flash HTML5 Builder or something like that. And if they have a story that is reasonably compatible, such that if you're using, basically developing current Flash stuff 6 months or a year from now, and they say, oh, well, the latest builder will now generate this, it generates concurrent versions of Flash, or there's a slow migration in the Flash player itself to use more native component, browser component rendering, so the Flash is not totally Flash anymore. It's a hybrid. I could see them, and I understand there's a lot of technical issues with that, but I could see them adopting that quicker. Just they've got too much of an influence in that market right now, and it's probably a fairly cash rich market for them to just say we're not doing this anymore. And there's value in having tools that allow you to do what they do. It's just that the end result of using those tools 2 years from now might not be a traditional Flash file. It might be something else.
Right. Well, I don't know if that I think that moment will happen sooner or later. They'll say they'll stop developing the Flash plugin for desktop computer browsers. But as for a complete replacement of what Flash does, I don't know if that will always it will happen at least with the same advantages. Actually, we comment about that in a previous podcast, specifically about certain features that are not yet fully available in all browsers that say that they support HTML5 APIs, like for instance, video recording and audio capture. But there is one. Well, I'm not sure if we can call it a feature, which is the fact that when you generate an SWF file, it's sort of an encapsulated binary that it's not, well, I'm not saying impossible because it's not impossible, but it's not easy to steal the code of the components that is inside. Although there are disassemblers, it's not something that will get you exactly the original source code. And I don't know how far you can provide the same in JavaScript. Can you provide a JavaScript file that is so well encapsulated that makes it hard for whoever wants to take advantage of something that is inside a JavaScript file to steal it? Well, I don't know if you can think that JavaScript will ever replace Flash in those terms. I don't know if you ever thought about that from that perspective.
Well, I think it could. Certainly, Adobe, as an example, has a lot of experience writing all the code to deal with video and audio and all of those features that are either missing or not very well done in HTML5. There's not a whole lot stopping them technically from releasing a lot of that and contributing it to some standards committee. And I mean, they've open sourced, or they're passing over some of their stuff over to the Apache Software Foundation. They could probably do more by contributing more of that, so that all the major browser people could get that code and put it in their JavaScript engines to have well-tested code. I mean, it would certainly be re-implemented, but you know what I'm saying? Or maybe I'm way off base there.
Well, actually, I was not thinking exactly about the code, whether it runs or not. I was thinking more about those people that develop Flash components and they sell them in the closed source format. I think it's a significant market there, and I know there are lots of sites that sell those components, and there are people making a living from selling those components, and they do not supply the source code. Although it's impossible to reverse engineer the...
I see what you mean, but my guess is that probably many of those people will be looking for some other avenue in the next couple of years, because the writing's on the wall. They're not going to... Yeah. Most of them will not be doing this and making the same amount of money 5 years from now at that.
Yes. Well, life moves on. They cannot expect the chicken of the golden eggs to last forever.
Sure.
If they are making a living from that, my advice is for them to get ready for Google to move on and drop Flash altogether, and all of a sudden their market will be much smaller, if existing at all.
Yep.
Well,
on that happy note.
Yeah. Well, at least it's an happy note for JavaScript fans, and many of them are Flash haters. Personally, I'm not a Flash hater. Flash had its place in the history of the web, and we never know how different the web would have been without Flash itself. At least Flash filled a hole that existed many years ago, and there was no way to achieve similar effects even with JavaScript.
Java applets, but anyway.
Well,
yes.
Maybe.
Yes.
But in the end, what succeeded was Flash, and just thinking about Flash video playing, which became very widespread after Flash plugin became quite disseminated, I think just seeing it from that point, it was quite I think it was quite important, but I think now it's time for move on without Flash. Okay, moving on with our podcast, I think it's time to talk about the latest JavaScript objects that were published in the JS Classes site. We're recording kind of early in the month, and there were not yet many components published there recently.
So instead, yeah, we will.
Well, we can always comment on the three that were published this month and move on with commenting with a few of the components that were published this year, 2011, that we think were more interesting. We cannot comment on all of them, but at least we can comment about a few that were more outstanding.
Well, this month, then what do we have here? We've got the first one I see is a from I can't pronounce the name. Let me read it slowly. Dienze, René Dienze.
Yeah,
am I saying that right? Yeah, from Germany.
We never know. Oh, is that spelled in German? But
this is a file directory listing object that will go scan. It's saying that it would scan through a directory, but I'm not sure if I was reading that correctly. If it's actually hitting the file system, or is it just going through a list list of files?
Also, I had that doubt, but then analyzing the code, basically what it does is just a trick that to list server-side image files. It creates image objects and with URLs that follow a certain pattern that is given, and if the image is loaded successfully, it reaches the conclusion that the image exists. So
that is a trick.
Yeah, it iterates over a range of numbers in the URL that is actually a template. It replaces a certain placeholder with numbers, and it iterates over a range of numbers to see which can be opened as images. So that's how it figures automatically if the images exist, because otherwise the browser side would not have a way to guess which files exist on the server side. And it's an interesting trick. I don't know if it's very useful in practice. It's probably for a very specific purpose that the author René had a certain need for.
Yeah.
But it's interesting anyway. Other than that, we also have ISO World, yet another great class from Artis Socinus, which is quite interesting. It uses the CSS transforms to pick three page elements, and each of them will act as visible faces of a cube that will be displayed in a sort of emulation of a 3D perspective, isometric perspective, to make it look like it is a 3D solid, to be a cube or something like that, and it gives a nice effect. I think it even lets you define another element that will act as the ground and another that will act as the shadow of the cube. So what Arthurs did is to adjust the CSS transform parameters to give this nice effect of a 3D.
Wow! All that's done with CSS. That is wild.
Yeah. Well, JavaScript is used to adjust those.
Okay. Well, yeah, you know what I meant. It's not. I thought it was a canvas trick at first, but no. I get it. it's just transforms. Wow.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if, what you can do in practice to make use this other than give a very impressive effect of something that you want to put in your pages. I don't know if you can also use some rotation to make the cube rotate. Well, in that case, I think you need more than three faces of solid. But still, it's impressive.
Yeah, I think it would probably give, it's certainly just now, it's just given me some ideas about things that could be done with CSS transforms.
Exactly.
That I would never have thought of that.
Yeah.
Interesting, very interesting.
Well, as long as your browser supports CSS 3 transforms.
Okay, Netscape 4, it's awesome.
Well, Netscape 4. Well, Netscape 4, it's like, what, 12 years ago?
Yes, good enough.
Well, and that is one of the yet another of the three classes that I would like it were released. So the third one is an image selector object that it is also interesting in the sense that lets you pick an image from a list and use select inputs to switch between the images. And but once you click to a different option of the select list, you can it already shows the image associated with that option, so you don't have to reload the page to see the a preview of the option being of the image associated with that option. And this is yet another great class from Arthur Sossin's. And well, this is the third of the three that were published this month
so far.
Yeah. And well, now moving to the selection of classes that were published in 2011, Michael, which ones do you think were probably more outstanding in your opinion?
Well, I'm not sure how much my opinion counts, but there were a few that there's one that I had remembered from earlier this year from Jean-Baptiste Demont, which was the Google Map marker tool or class to let you more easily place custom markers over Google Maps. It's not something that had never been done before, but it was it just for some reason kind of stuck out with me, stuck in my head. As we were putting this list together, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that one. That one, it just stuck with me. That's all.
Yeah. It's interesting because it also supports clustering of markers, which is a very useful function because when you have many markers to display and they are concentrated on a certain region, just shows you just a one single mark.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is important for Google Maps API, because if you show too many marks on the page, it becomes very slow.
Mm-hmm. There was another one that this happens. I think this is a... Oh, no. Where was it? I lost it. I have a page up here. Yeah, this was... you said that you think we talked about this before, but I don't remember us talking about this. This was...
I was wondering.
This was the spin wheel, jQuery spin wheel. It's a jQuery plugin that builds a spinning wheel, like a game thing, from game shows. And does it all in Canvas, and you can add the demo page lets you add multiple names, spin a wheel, and it rotates the wheel pretty quickly, and all the names are rotated in an arc. And when I was looking at this, it's I was digging through the code a little bit because I didn't need to build a specifically a spinning wheel like this, but I had needed to. I was building a demo for somebody, and I was trying to do a something that looked like a slot machine, like with spinning things. That's when I first thought those kind of spinning wheels. But having tried to do that myself, it made me realize how difficult some of this stuff is. And this is one of those that when I look at the code of anybody who makes good JavaScript stuff, a good reusable JavaScript stuff, I'm always in envy because I've been doing this for a long time and I don't feel like I'm getting that much better. I know I am compared to 5 and 10 years ago, but I don't feel like I'm getting that much better. But and when I look at somebody else's code, it's always kind of fun to see how did they do. Oh, that's how you do this. That's how you do that.
Yeah.
So that was another one that kind of jumped out at me as interesting from this year.
Yeah. Well, on my part, just also would like to add like a couple of two other classes, but just but first, just to give credit to who should be mentioned is Ron Yu of the United States that developed that spin wheel class.
Oh, Roy. It's Roy.
Roy.
Roy Yu. Yeah. Thank you, Roy. It
sounds Chinese, this name. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the two classes that I wanted to mention, well, actually, we also commented about them earlier, is one of them is JSGet from Fabian Vogelsteller. Not sure if this pronunciation is correct. He's from Germany, and basically what class does is something that is very useful for single page applications that need to detect when you use your browser button or use maybe a link that points to the same URL but with a different hash. And since that will not make the page reload, the application needs to detect that to be able to update the screen. And this is very useful for single page applications, as I mentioned. And the other class that I also want to like to highlight for this year is Light Source.
One of
many great classes submitted by Arthur Sossins. And this one basically also achieves a neat effect on the screen, which is basically to adjust the several attributes of a certain page element, like the color and the shadow of the page element, considering a virtual light source, which could be moved around the page, and depending on the position of the light, it will change the shadow of that element, not just the intensity but also the direction. So if you move to one side, it will show the shadow to the opposite side, and it gives a very nice effect, a very mm-hmm. impressive one. I don't know what kind of uses you could do with this kind of component, but it suddenly gives a very impressive effect to you can use to put in to make your site users get the attention of them when they get to your site pages, where you would use a component like this.
Oh, you know, you could put a light source against a 3D isomorphic box.
Yeah.
And put a shadow that way.
Well, that would be a very interesting combination of components.
Yes, Archers, get on that.
Yeah.
Make that happen.
Now you just gave him yet another idea. If he didn't have thought about that already. Well, greetings to Artuns for this and many other components. He's a very valuable contributor from Latvia, and I hope he can continue to have time to submit more great components next year. And the same goes to other contributors of the site. And also related with the components that and the authors that submit to the site, I would like to comment very briefly on a feature that was just released just this week when we are recording, which is still before Christmas. And basically it is a report message that is sent by email to each author of the site that we would like to encourage somehow to so they can not only contribute more classes but also update the current classes that they have submitted, but they probably forgot to send the new versions, the new developments that they made. And this report message basically shows some information. It's basically a personalized message that shows how each author is doing in terms of rankings, different rankings of the site, the number of users that they have since the beginning, since they sent their packages, as well in the latest week. And other than that, the report also gives some advice on how they can improve their contributions so they keep raising in the rankings. And I hope with this it encourages the authors to send more and better packages and participate in an even more positive way for the benefit of the whole community. Now practically reaching the end of our podcast, Michael, I think you wanted to comment something about, I don't know if you have already ready to comment on the topics of the next issue of the JS Mag magazine.
I don't think I have the stuff right in front of me, and it's a little
too early.
It's a little early in the month. I mean, we have let me see if I can pull it up. We had something last month that should be in this month, but I'm hoping that it is. But we should be having, we talked to Dino Gambone last month, and or to maybe 2 months ago, and he, that was last month, and he was supposed to have something in a second series in his offline mobile app development piece, but that didn't get in, so that we should have that for January. And we have another piece on server-side, another continued series with from Mike Schwartz on server-side JavaScript. He's going to be talking about, I think, some ORM tools for server-side JavaScript, potentially a piece on closures, and another couple things which I'm not sure we'll have yet. So kind of it's a little early. Normally we're kind of solidified at this point, but December is always a little rough because everybody's taking time off for the holidays. So it's always a challenge, and that kind of brings me up to, as always, we're always on the lookout for good writers, or maybe you're not a great writer, you don't think you're a great writer, but you've been working on some cool stuff, or you've got some neat things that you'd like to share with other people. We can help you do that through JSMag, and we pay.
We have editors
that you can work with to help clean up if English isn't your first language. Usually we can help you get past that.
Well, other than that, I wonder if you would like to mention any of the authors that sent more contributions to your magazine this year.
It's I don't have a list offhand of all. Certainly Mike Schwartz and Dino Gambone have been great contributors over the last over the past year. David Calhoun has been doing a really good job of keeping us keeping the news up to date, both in the magazine, the PDF magazine, but also at jsmag.com. He does he's done a pretty good job of keeping our news column up to date there. Let me see if I can, there was one other thing if I can pull up. I've got too many pages of this stuff. It's actually hard for me to just go through and pick out names right now because Jean-Baptiste Demont was actually a JS Classes contributor, and because we ended up talking, he gave us a really nice piece too. So we've had a lot of great, probably 40-50 authors over the last year, and then the same for Groovy Mag. It's just great to get to work with so many sharp people.
Yeah, and it was BR to mention everybody, but I'm sure the other people that were not mentioned will understand. Anyway, we're practically at the end of this podcast. I just like to comment one thing, is that I'm going to try, and I would like to emphasize try, to have a Portuguese edition of this podcast, the Lately in JavaScript. I don't know how we like call it, but if all goes well, and I can manage to make time also to record that podcast and every month, and I'll be recording the podcast also once a month, and with the help of Felipe Moura, we'll have a sort of a Portuguese version of the podcast, talking about pretty much the same topics related with JavaScript, but probably more focus on what goes on in the JavaScript scene in Brazil and probably Portugal as well, because the podcast will be spoken in Portuguese. And other than that, next year I plan to work on a project to implement a new service that I cannot comment yet, but a part of it will be written in Node.js. At least that's my intention. I hope all goes well, and this decision to make that part in JavaScript on the server, actually it is not that part is not web related, but as I mentioned, I cannot give more details already, probably in a few months, but I hope that will also will give me time to develop more general purpose JavaScript components that I will be publishing in JS Classes.
Cool.
Well, any JavaScript plans for you the next year that you would like to comment?
Nothing that advanced. Probably, I still have a lot of Grails and PHP work ahead of me for several months, but possibly some of that work with Mulberry, playing around with that. Yeah. And Probably just looking for more things to add in, like Humane.js, smaller little widgets and libraries that I can use to add the nice UI effects that I want to have.
No, that's great. Well, on that note, we have practically ended the, yet another edition of the Lately in JavaScript podcast. 2011 was a great year. I hope 2012 will be even better, even though even knowing that the world is expected to end.
Oh, stop.
Okay. Well, that's what, I saw in a certain movie that somehow gave a simulation of what some people expect to happen. Of course, I'm not a believer, but that's another
discussion. I'm not a believer, discussion. Yes.
Well, Michael, thank you once again for your participation, not just this episode, but all the episodes of 2011.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I hope I can count with you next year as well.
Sure. Oh, let me say, palabra de despedida.
Okay. Google Translator is your friend. Okay. Thank you again. Thank you for everybody for listening. Anybody that would like to show, send your comments, eventually participate in future episodes, feel free to contact us. Not just for that, but also to send your components to the JS Classes site and eventually your articles to JS Magazine.
Yep.
And I think that is all for now.
We'll talk to you in 2012. Bye bye.